Hello and welcome to the Digital Insights Podcast, a podcast brought to you by the Australian Government's digital profession, keeping the Australian public service digital ready. I'm Fleur Anderson and I'm your host. Today, I acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on the lands of the Ngunnawal people, the traditional custodians of the land. I pay my respects to their elders past and present. I extend that request to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening. So the topic for today is leadership at all levels. So it's easy to see how someone can lead from the top of an organisation. I mean, you're the boss, right? They have to do what you say. But what if you're new or at a junior level? What if you're a mid-level person who's just starting to build your own team? So we're going to talk to three Australian public service leaders, all at different stages of their career. They're going to give us some really practical advice and insights on how to navigate the challenges of leadership from within the APS and with a particular focus on people working in digital roles. Joining us in Melbourne, we have Suzanne Aitken, who is the General Manager of Project Delivery Services Division within Technology Services Group for Services Australia. She's responsible for delivering the IT components for some of our most significant transformation projects. Her leadership experience spans 20 years across strategic planning, delivery, and operations. She's also led strategic governance, management, and optimizations functions and major technology programs. She's worked and lived across multiple countries across Europe and Asia. And now she's here in Melbourne talking to us. Hi, Suzanne, how are you?
Hey, I'm really well.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And in Adelaide, we have Alexander Nitschke, who works in the Data Integration Delivery Assurance and Strategy branch of the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Alex is an executive leader in the data governance and strategy field with a focus on project and change management in government data. So Alex is also a mentor and online facilitator to university students and their universities on data governance. Hi, Alex. It's great to have you as well joining from Adelaide.
G'day, Fleur. Thanks for having me on.
And with me here in Canberra, we have Sophia Athanasopoulos, who is a digital designer with the Australian Government's Department of Veterans Affairs. She's part of the Digital Transformation Agency's Emerging Talent Program because she's very talented and she's really passionate about user experience and interface design with a keen interest in creating accessible and functional designs. Hi, Sophia. It's great to have someone actually in the studio.
Hi, Fleur. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, thank you so much, guys, for joining us. And we might start off with a couple of questions. So turning to you, Suzanne, can you please tell us a bit more about your background? I mean, you've had 20 years of experience in leadership, but it hasn't all been in the public service, has it?
No, that's right. I joined public service just shy of 2 years ago. So a predominant part of my career has been in private industry. I started my career in HR and came fresh out of uni with an HR degree, and all respect to those individuals that have an HR career. But after 4 years, I decided that that wasn't quite for me. And so learned through my career to take opportunities when they present themselves. And so my career has spanned from HR to large scale program delivery to strategy roles and to operation roles across a multi-factor industries. So I've worked in manufacturing, worked for Bacardi for a while, which was certainly interesting. Worked in financial services, some consultancies, and also business process outsourcing as well. So now into public service and loving it.
Wow. So working for Bacardi, that's kind of interesting. I mean, do you have the same process as managing teams in an alcohol manufacturing company compared to something that's more digital, or is it all the same?
No, it's fundamentally different, but that was very early on in my career. I think I was about 24 at the time, and it was Bacardi had taken over one of the brands. Clearly from my accent, you can tell that I'm not from Australia originally. So it was in Scotland. So think about consolidating multiple distillery sites into a new manufacturing plant. It certainly taught me how to build resilience.
That sounds diplomatic. So now turning to Sophia. So Suzanne worked for Bacardi in her younger times. And so Sophia is our newest public service recruit. When we caught up the other day, you said that if I'd asked you a couple of years ago what you'd be doing now, well, this wasn't really on your radar, was it?
No, absolutely not. Coming from the music industry, DJing and organising events, the public service is the last place I thought I would be. But as Suzanne said, an opportunity presented itself and I thought it was important to take it.
Oh, that's wonderful. I can't wait to hear a bit more about that in a minute. So, Alex, you're in Adelaide juggling a fair bit at the moment, not only sort of just coming out of lockdown. You've got the Australian Bureau of Statistics census that's going to be going ahead in the next couple of weeks during a pandemic, which is kind of interesting. And you mentor university students. And on top of that, you have four young sons. So how do you handle all of this? Can you tell us a bit more about what you've got on your plate?
Thanks, Fleur. It's certainly a busy household, and my wife runs her own business full time as well. So we try and stay fairly organised. We have Sunday evening planning sessions, much like you would for any business project, and usually over a glass of red, try and work out what we've got ahead during the week. But you know, we accept a certain amount of crazy is just part of our life, and kind of embrace that. But a bit about me. So I started back at the ABS in 2008, working in sort of economic surveys after a couple of years in the banking sector. Decided banking wasn't really for me, didn't really like the culture and climate of it. But yeah, public servant ever since. After that, worked in a few interesting roles, being seconded out to different departments, helping them with their data strategies and using data to measure priorities and policy measures, that kind of thing. And then a few years helping the ABS with a large statistical business transformation program that went from about 2015 to 19. So a lot of digital disruption across those different projects. And for someone who's not a techie themselves, definitely getting to see a lot of the value in using public data and information to help strategize and improve the way we live and decisions we make around different government departments, that kind of thing.
Well, that's great. Thanks so much for that. And that's so interesting. I think, you know, a Sunday afternoon planning session and the acceptance of a little bit of crazy could be applied across, well, our work and home lives. I'm taking those two leadership skills or tips from you right now. So back to our panel. Sophia, so as we mentioned, you're sort of the newest member of the APS in this panel. You went from being a philosophy student, a DJ and music event organiser. I mean, what was the transition like? Tell us about your first day.
The transition was a bit of a shock. My first day, you know, you're going from working at night to working during the day to dark rooms to bright lights. There was definitely a lot of transition. And I remember probably the biggest impression that was made on me on my first day was all us graduates received a printed out org chart, which showed the department in its hierarchy of how everyone works together. The secretary is obviously at the top and everyone else sits underneath. That kind of hierarchy was something I wasn't really used to, because the creative industries, especially more in the DIY space, it's about people using their skills and almost assuming roles based on what they're capable to do. So having this kind of structure was, yeah, definitely a shock.
Yeah. And so that's quite interesting that that in the music industry, as you said, it's do it yourself. And so how have you used those skills that you learned from all the trials and tribulations of, you know, running music events and the pitfalls that happen? How did you then transfer that across into your current role?
Well, it's interesting going back to that first day again. We were spoken to by the repatriation commissioner, and he has a military background, as does a lot of the senior leadership in the Department of Veteran Affairs, which is obviously very fitting. And he posed the question to all the graduates of, what are you going to bring to the fight? And from that, I thought back to, you know, even my job application and how my ability to draw connections from my diverse experience was, I think, what made me a good candidate. So from philosophy, I draw my critical problem-solving abilities. And DJing and event organizing, it's all about how people are going to have an experience, which is what is the basis of user experience design. It's about being able to respond to people's needs to create a desirable outcome. So I think, yeah, being able to draw those connections was the biggest way that I've been able to bring that experience with me, because I think we all bring our unique experiences, no matter how diverse they are. Our ability to bring those skills to a new task at hand is what...
It's very interesting. So, I mean, I suppose when you think about what you'd be doing as a, you know, DJ at an event, you are picking up real time what people's user experience is and making sure that they're having a good time, and that might be having to make a decision on the fly that this isn't working, let's do something else. I guess that's exactly what your user experience work is also, you know, about.
Yeah, absolutely. In DJing, you're getting the feedback in real time in user experience. You know, it's a more drawn out process of you do your user testing and then you get feedback back, and then you can go back and revise and make decisions based on that way, obviously in a critical problem solving way based on the information you receive.
Yes, that's so interesting. So Suzanne, you just heard Sophia's discussion about, well, the one of the different ways of leadership is, you know, from the military, and what are you going to bring to the fight? So you've had experience leading teams in the, both the private and public sector. So what do you think is the secret to good leadership? And I mean, have you got any models that you use and as sort of your go-to, you know, success tips that you can deploy every time that you start a new project?
Yeah, look, I've got a variety of experience of managing different teams. I've been fortunate enough to work and live in multiple countries, which adds a whole new flavor, which is the cultural element of leading teams as well. And I think that as I've gone through my career, fundamentally, people are people. And so more time spent actually building a connection with understanding what makes people tick, having them in the right roles. But I look at my leadership role quite clearly as three things. I tend to simplify things. And so in my role of leading teams, whether it be delivery teams of hundreds of people, whether it be an operations team of thousands of people, or whether it be more niche strategy teams that tend to be smaller scale, it is three fundamental things in terms of my philosophy. First is set the vision. So as a leader, you're responsible for ensuring that there is a vision that people are excited by and want to be led by you. I think that then it is about understanding what are the blockers that impede any of your team from actually being able to achieve those results. And then thirdly, back to that people piece, you're responsible for people's physical and mental well-being. And I think that when you focus in on those three things, the thing that I've learned is that it puts people at the core. And that can sometimes sound a bit trite, but it's very genuine for me that I have a big belief that you're nothing unless the people that you're surrounded with actually want to be led by you and inspired by what you're setting out as being that vision. And so building that connection, and I think that the larger that the teams become that you lead, you realize that actually your influence is only really your leadership team. So currently it would be 8 people. And then within that framework and the hierarchy that Sophia spoke to there, in most corporate environments that you have and is necessary to get outcomes achieved, you realize that it's about building really solid connections and understanding with your leadership team, because they're then responsible for managing their teams. And so understanding that span of control that you actually have and influence, I think, is really important as well.
So, Suzanne, you mentioned three things: that outlining the vision, there's also understanding the blockages and asking your team to be honest about what are the blockages to achieving that vision, and then the mental and physical well-being of the team. How do you encourage people to be honest about blockages? I mean, we hear quite a lot when you're talking to team members from different hierarchies that, oh, I didn't want to say anything because it will, you know, it's going to upset my boss if I say that's a stupid idea, that's not going to work. I mean, how do you encourage that culture of being able to be upfront and honest and constructive when it comes to dismantling these blockages?
So, look, I think two things. I think is you go through your own career and you lead larger teams and take on more autonomy in terms of the roles that you have, it's really important, I believe, for a leader to understand what it takes to get the work done. And so by that, when I look at my own career and the variety of different roles that I've had, whether it be delivery, strategy, operations, or just the general people aspect of it, I have a really solid understanding of when I set a program of work off, what it takes to get the work done. And so there's learned experience there, with 20 plus years of experience that helped me understand and know where the blockers are going to be. So I guess the part of it is learned experience. Part of it also is the environment that you create. So lead from the front, my behaviours and how I put myself across and how I choose to communicate and the language that I use also helps encourage my team know and understand what they're able to communicate in a safe environment, and know that that information isn't going to be used in a way that's negatively going to impact them. But also encouraging people to speak up, lots of planning sessions. So it depends on whether or not, you know, you're in an environment where you're using agile frameworks, that you can spend a lot of time each quarter with your leadership team offsite, actually having a safe environment with time spent where you can plan and understand and do a bit like Alex was talking on, you do the Sunday planning. Homeschooling with my kids, we do retros at the end of the night, depending on how good the day was, just to kind of go, okay, what do we want to change for tomorrow? So I think a lot of it is about the behaviours and leadership style that you bring, that naturally, going back to what I was saying before, people are people, you know, kind of Maslow's hierarchy. They're looking for the basics to be in place for that trust to be there for them to then open up and feel a sense of psychological safety when they're with you and in amongst. But I think a lot of it is about demonstrating what you do with the information and demonstrating that you're there to support them.
Well, I love that, and I love the fact that you do nightly retros with your kids. That sounds a lot more constructive than some of the conversations I have with mine at the end of the day. So when we spoke earlier, Suzanne, you mentioned I think calling it questionable career advice is probably being too kind, but this was earlier on in your career about returning to work after having children and taking a leadership role. Can you just tell us a little bit about that time?
Yes. So it was after I had my first daughter and came back from maternity leave. And anybody that's listening in, when you come back after having your first child, and a duration of maternity leave, I've taken a year off, it can be quite daunting. And when I reflect on it, it's more your confidence is a bit knocked, you know, your kind of sense of self and how you juggle working life with this new beautiful being that you brought into the world. And I remember walking into the building on my first day, and it was one of my old bosses came through the turnstile and said, "Oh, you're back. You know that your career's over now that you've had kids. You were a pretty determined, female, but, you know, what are you going to do now?" And I remember just thinking, isn't that interesting? Why on earth would you, number one, say those words? But number two, that's interesting that that's somebody's belief system. So it lit a fire in my belly.
I think it would light a fire in anyone's belly hearing that right now, just quietly.
to say that absolutely is not my journey. That's not my adventure path. And if you want me to expand, I can happily talk to some of the things that as a result of
you had basically the ultimate revenge on that. So can you just tell us what you did next?
It was a number of years later, after I had come back to work. I worked 3 days a week, took on a promotional role, quite a massive program of work to deliver, and did that part-time. So that was like tick number one to prove it. And they were quite surprised that I was able to do that. But fast forward a few years, one of the things that I was given carriage of at a financial services organization that I worked at was to look after our talent pipelines. And so I had this wonderful team that we were trying to debunk the myth. So they had 1,200 vacancies in the organization. And going through your normal graduate programs and kind of STEM programs, autism programs, they weren't really giving that full talent pool that was available out in the market. So I presented to the leadership group to say, look, I think there are some other untapped markets that we could go into. Here's the hypothesis. Will you back me and give me a chance to prove it out? So they agreed. And one of the talent pools that we wanted to prove out, being a female myself and having two daughters, was that there is this untapped market, which is women that have taken a substantial period of time off to have children and that can't get back into the workforce because they generally have 5+ years of maternity leave. And so what we did was a marketing campaign to just test the waters and see what was out there. And we tested it in Melbourne. The response rate that we got was overwhelming. And the program of work was branded as Return to Work. And it was about supporting females that had been out of work for 5+ years to get them back into working life. Now, the myth that was out there was that, well, if women have been out of work for that length of time, they need to be retrained. And we're saying, well, I've had two children. I've got a number of females that work in my team part-time, full-time, with an array of different backgrounds. I don't think anybody needs to be retrained. They just need to be given the opportunity and then brought back into the workplace, dust off their skills in terms of any, you know, Microsoft products that might have moved forward in the last 5+ years, but give them an opportunity. And what you find is that females tend to have had their confidence knocked a bit. So give them a 2-week hardcore induction program to re-immerse them back in with the support that they need and let's see what happens. Now, we ended up having a pilot program that was to bring on 14 females. We had in excess of 615 for that pilot program that we had to down select to 40.
Wow.
The response was overwhelming. And what we got was not just entry level. We got every single level right up to executive leadership positions of females wanting to come back into the workplace. So I'm delighted to say it's now in its third year as well. And a number of different organizations leveraging off the model that we put in place. And that's been expanded out into 5 different countries now as well, including India.
Really?
So, a beautiful thing to be part of, to be able to show not only my daughters, yes, you know, believe in something and nurture and promote, because I think part of what leadership is also about, as you journey through your own career and you build up a vast amount of experience, is then being able to utilize that in a really positive way and give back to the community.
You must have goosebumps when you think back on that moment.
It does give me goosebumps. I'm very proud of that piece of work.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You're listening to the Digital Profession Insight Series. Be digital ready and join the digital profession today. Visit digitalprofession.gov.au for more information.
So, Alex, turning to you, as I mentioned, you're the father of 4 boys. I hope you've never had some sort of helpful career advice like that.
Probably not to the same extent, but I'm sure Suzanne, my wife, and you could have a very long and robust discussion about the things you've been told. My wife's had 4 years off out of 8 to have our 4 kids, and A lot of that wasn't because we necessarily believed in the certain gender roles. It's just trying to manage economically and with work and everything as best you can with what's available to you as a new parent. So definitely hadn't had that advice. But at the same token, I also firmly believe that there's also different ways to succeed as a male in the workforce too. So I don't tend to think it's about climbing to the very top of the tree. I've, as you would have seen in my experience, I've kind of found a balance with my life that allows me to see and have time with my kids and do things I enjoy, like the tutoring, and balance my work out. So I can do something that's really meaningful and interesting through my public service career, while also attain that balance. So I also think, guys out there, it's not all about becoming the CEO or the head of the department. If you want to have a family life and a balance that allows you to do the things you enjoy with your kids, then that's not something to be frowned on as well. I know my wife has had a lot of that advice, and hence she's running her own business now and kicking a lot of goals that were seen as maybe being impossible coming back to the public service. She used to work at the public service as well. That's a great outcome and experience, Suzanne. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, that is really interesting, Alex. I really like your perspective there that, it's also, it comes to men's expectations as well, that they can actually do more than one thing at the same time, like you do, the work that you do mentoring students, and that it's about finding a place where you're doing meaningful work. And quickly turn to Sophia here. When we spoke the other day, we were talking about, well, what's your leadership aspirations? And you had some interesting thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially for me coming into the APS as, I guess, a bit more of an unconventional graduate, where, before this I was in the music industry being a DJ and event organizer, whereas other grads were coming into it with a headset of you enter the APS to climb the ranks and make your way up that organizational chart to get as high as you can. But I think for me, my goal has just been to find where I fit best, basically, and where I can use my skills in a way that is most meaningful and exciting. So for both the services I'm providing and for myself as a person.
That's interesting. It's sort of that question that whether you're a generalist or a specialist, and what's going to bring you the most satisfaction, I suppose, and your own opportunities to lead wherever you are. Yes, that's great. Look, coming back to you, Alex, so you've got a huge amount of training in change management. So I would imagine that you would have some tips and tricks about how to manage a team in a workplace, as along with, the work that you do with facilitation of workshops and students at a university level. What sort of things are in your go-to bag?
Sure. So I think we always talk about one of the keys being having that senior commitment from our leaders in the organisation, investing in managing the change and giving us the tools and things we need, whether that be through using something like ProSci and doing readiness assessments and change plans and all the kind of rigour of that kind of thing. That's obviously one aspect of trying to understand what the change means to your people. But at the same time, having lived through it as a team leader or an executive and middle management kind of level, you've got to be able to and be willing to kind of take that information in. What does it mean? What is it telling you? We're not just kind of setting it in the schedule to say, we're going to do these readiness assessments, we're going to ask these questions of our staff. We're actually planning to do something with the information. And that's where in recent projects, I've been involved in, particularly to do with the ABS's new website infrastructure and that kind of thing. We've used Agile quite effectively because it's, like Suzanne mentioned, you can have retros and you can have stand-ups and regular kind of touch base with your team to see how things are actually improving or changing rather than just filing things away in a filing cabinet. So having those tools and structures, I think, is really important, but also you've got to have the mindset within whatever project or program you're working in that we are actually going to move with the change, and whether that be new technology or new information about how people are feeling or how what they need. It's not just sort of a token gesture. On a personal level, in the last few years, I've had a really good experience through the transformation with a leader that's kind of been, I think Suzanne touched on this, that kind of servant nature of, well, I'm here to give you what you need to succeed, and kind of recognising that you might be sitting across from someone or working with someone in a team, and you might have totally different experiences about the transformation you're going through in terms of whether they're positive or negative for you based on a lot of your personal factors. So I've had some really good leaders that have acknowledged that, understood that different people are coming from different experiences, and you know, understanding that, giving those different people what they need, and whether that's training or advice or just support or maybe a different direction in their career. I think recognising that it's not just a one-size-fits-all approach, and it's also not just a we'll throw money at the problem approach. It has to be a buy-in and a cultural thing for all the people involved in the project you're working in.
And Alex, now one thing I wanted to sort of touch on with you, and Suzanne mentioned it as well, about building confidence in your team members and resilience. Now, you had an interesting experience a couple of years ago, didn't you, where you and your team came up with the best plan ever that, well, I'll let you tell the story.
Yes, I think it was about 5 years ago now. We were asked to come up with an onboarding schedule for our 200-odd teams at the ABS doing statistical work to start using all of these new systems that the transformation was going to be delivering them after 20 or 30 years of using the same stuff. So first we did a quick Google of what onboarding meant, and sat down and talked to everyone and planned out a five-year schedule to onboard all of these 200 areas to the new systems. And we did that based in good faith on what we were told in terms of how hard it was going to be, what teams would need, when they would need it, how much time they would need to develop these things. And then we started plotting along our schedule. And by the time the very first team actually started using or onboarding, as we found out, to any of these systems was actually 18 months after the whole original schedule was supposed to have finished. So we went quite on time, and I think I did over 50 or 60 variations of this schedule over time. The lesson learned there was you can't just sort of set things in stone and expect them to work perfectly from start to finish. There was a lot of assumptions and uncertainties that were made at the start there. And probably in that project or program, we were a little bit reluctant to change things as new information came to hand. We were a little bit slow to jump at new information and to understand it. So going forward into a more recent program of work, we took more of an agile approach, and I think we actually did our very first schedule on a piece of butcher's paper at the pub after a long lunch. It had all the cutlery cleared out to the side and a few texters and markers. And that piece of butcher's paper proved to be far more useful than a 3 or 4 month consultation process on a schedule that really didn't make sense at the end of the day. So I think you have to do things that are fit for purpose. And obviously there's a lot of requirements to meet in some of these larger programs to show your thinking and show your direction. But also I think there should be that level of kind of pushback to say, this is what we know now, and this is what we can kind of land our feet on, but we're going to have some new things come up along the way that we can't necessarily be sure of at the moment, particularly when it comes to dealing with new technologies or trying to stick new technologies together with older ones while also doing a business. We often talked about in that ABS transformation the idea of trying to rebuild an aeroplane while it's flying in the sky, and that's kind of what we were doing with the 200 statistical programs that were all running, and everyone still needed their labour force information or CPI information while trying to not make any mistakes in stitching these things together. So I guess the quick takeaway was you can't solve all the world's problems on day one, but you can certainly kind of set up a culture and an understanding, a willingness to move with and flow with changes. And that might be using things like Agile and different change management processes and activities. But at the end of the day, you have to have the culture and the willingness to engage with those along the way and use the information that comes back towards you as it happens.
So, Suzanne, I could see you nodding furiously at one part of Alex's story about how they weren't quick enough to take on new information. I'm summarising here, Alex, but as it was coming in and then adapting the plan. So have you had similar examples in, you know, leading yes. teams like that?
Yes. I mean, look, most change programs now have some relevance to technology, right? So there's always a piece of tech. And to have any programs in this day and age that is planned out for 5 years in advance and doesn't have a methodology applied where you are constantly reviewing and pivoting, that in 5 years' time, the technology landscape has changed so much that what you set out to achieve will have changed in so many different facets that it's crazy not to have something that is more iterative. So I tend to, with my teams, lead from the front to say, right, let's set an ambition. And it's okay to have an ambition and a vision for 5 years. So you map out visually, because most human beings require something to visually connect to understand the path. So have that vision, iterate, break it down into bite-sized chunks. Generally for the teams that I run, that's about 90 days. So you can sprint cycle of about 90 days. But start with a concept which is highest value return, right? So you've got lots of different agile terms that are out there that can be used, but I tend to say to the team, there is so many things that are always open to be fixed or tinkered with or redesigned, but what's going to have the biggest impact? And put that at the front of the queue, have your backlog of things that you want to get to, but constantly be really questioning, is the value there being delivered? And has something changed in the ecosystem that means that as a leadership team, we need to come together to replan and to pivot? So the most recent piece that we did in Services Australia was planning the infrastructure transformation roadmap for 5 years out. Broke it down and said, right, realistically, we could plan that for 90-day sprint cycles for about 18 months. And then every 12 weeks, we get together. And so the last one took place about 5 weeks ago. And just in the first quarter of getting started, we pivoted quite heavily going into the next quarter. And it's the communications that you then send back out to the teams and all of the ProSci components. And, you know, basic change management principle is spend 70% of your time actually building people's awareness. So don't think that just because you've sent out one email or you've had one conversation that you ticked off the communication box. You've got to constantly be chatting with your teams and helping them understand what's changed, what role do they play in it, how are we tracking to the outcome that we're trying to achieve. So as a leader, it's, you know, back to those three fundamentals. What's impeding the team getting there? And is everybody enjoying the journey as you go on?
Fabulous. Thank you for listening today. And I want to thank our guests, Suzanne, Sophia, and Alex. And I want to thank you for listening.
You've been listening to the Digital Professions Insights podcast. Find the Digital Insights podcast on all major podcast services. Stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn or Facebook. And of course, if you haven't done so yet, join the profession today. You'll get access to exclusive learning opportunities, accreditation of your skills, and the chance to connect with peers across government. Visit digitalprofession.gov.au for more information. See you next time.